this or something more largely planned on these lines might be regarded as the schematic. Am I right? Has somebody else, does somebody else have a marker on where we are to begin?
I think that's right. It would be, this is something more largely planned on these lines. It's 9:55.
In my book, it is 9:92.
So, I think that's a good place to begin. In case we have already finished that paragraph, still it doesn't hurt to start there, because it's a good starting point for new ideas that Sri Aurobindo is going to elaborate. But we've come to a very important point here, the stage in this chapter, where he has introduced the third of the three transformations. This chapter and the previous chapter, two chapters actually, this chapter is called The Ascent Towards Supermind. The previous chapter was The Triple Transformation. These two large chapters concern themselves with this evolutionary ascent out of what is called the ignorance, the condition of separation, division, suffering, and death, which is, you know, the condition that all living things are marked by in this universe, to a possible transformation of that condition to one of shadowless happiness in a divine life. Now, this kind of set of transformations, spiritual transformation, is taken up by him in these two chapters. The first one deals with the first of these transformations, the psychic transformation, or the second, and to some extent, the cosmic transformation, or transformation of the spiritual consciousness. This chapter deals more fully with the spiritual transformation, and at this point, he has introduced, I'll come to the third of the three transformations, which is the supramental transformation. What marks this third stage in the paragraph that we have just finished is the fact that the limitations that the cosmos is under the paradigm of are overcome here. The possibility of changing the basic conditions of cosmic existence exists here, because this is a transcendental consciousness from which the entire cosmic situation could be said to have taken form. Now, this kind of an idea, ultimately, I think when we ended last time, the last paragraph that we read, Sri Aurobindo was talking about this kind of a transformation, a change of human consciousness and a transformation of human nature through identification with the consciousness of supermind, was something that ultimately had its effect not merely at the individual level, but at the cosmic level. You know, this is a very powerful statement and extremely bold, because in a sense what it leads to, and I think we ended at this point last time, is exemplified by the line in Savitri which says, one man's perfection yet may change the world or save the world. Now this, one man's perfection yet may save the world, ultimately, you know, is making the case for a identification of the human person with some supreme personal principle that may be seen as the very origin of the entire creation or manifestation. And that your hard drive to them?
Yes, Devishishtha, I think it was my hard drive.
Okay.
I opened a PDF version of like Divine in there. Yes.
Okay. So, this kind of idea that an individual may arrive at some kind of consciousness which can be transformative, not only at the individual level but at the cosmic level, is something which is, ultimately it's a kind of a mystic dream, one may say, that Sri Aurobindo is giving in a kind of a concrete formula over here as the next step in the possibility of human evolution. It's a kind of universal condition that he is speaking of over here. Now, if we look, last week when we talked about this, I think Janet raised the point about the Christian mythos and the fact that in a way or in a sense, the entire idea of Christ embodied this very notion. And so this is true because we have to go back and talk about the entire spiritual history of mankind as in some way or form marked by this grappling with the problem of what the Indian tradition has called avidya, or the ignorance. The sense of separation and the sense of, lack, sense of suffering and the reality of death, the subjection to these kinds of experiences which are unhappy is the very basis of seeking for a solution which either thinks about the whole creation as illusory or thinks about it in terms of some transformation. So now, to some extent, I think this is approached in different ways by different traditions. Now, we go back even to Buddhism, which is one of the first of these early major religious philosophies of the world. And we find that there too, this problem is tackled. This is why the entire Buddhist mythos begins with the grappling with the problem of suffering. And what we find is that it's carried in a little more esoteric manner, but I think one of the central places where this entire solution to the problem of suffering is carried is the hour or the night of the Buddha's enlightenment. What is it that constitutes the Buddha's enlightenment, and how is it arrived at? People don't know this very, very, sort of well. I mean, it's not very popularly known, but the description is very telling of the night of the Buddha's enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. What people usually know is the battle with Mara and the force of Mara. Now, this is very significant, but it occupies only the first watch or the first 4 hours of the night. Now, the Indian cycle of time or the clock, Indian clock, is broken into what are called praharas. And these praharas are each approximately 4 hours long. So this early evening first watch is overcome. The overcoming of these powers of darkness that attack the Buddha in a very expansion of consciousness of the Buddha begins. And the next watch of the night, he arrives at a knowledge of his own past lives, all his past lives, and the fact that this entire trajectory can be seen all at once. In other words, he arrives at an identification with the psychic being, the soul, and its existence. Now, after this, the next watch of the night, the next prahara, he moves out of the individual formulation of his own past lives into the universal consciousness where he can watch or see every individual's succession of lives. Therefore, and also identify with it. In other words, he can become any other history of life in any individual form. This ultimately leads, this experience ultimately leads him to a point where he can identify with any being on the universe. Now, the third watch, or actually the fourth watch, because the first was the battle with Mara, leads him outside this condition to one in which he sees all these lives of individuals are relative lives. They're all the dreams of God. That in a sense, he can wish them all away. He can accept them or reject them. He has the power of choice over the entire universal determination. Now, this is the point in which he enters into the transcendence. But the Buddha does not seek any power in the transcendence that can transform the condition of the universal consciousness, which we see in this night of transformation, the two major transformations, the psychic and the spiritual, take place in the Buddha. But the transcendent is experienced, but not used as a power of transforming the other conditions of consciousness. However, the Buddha goes around teaching the possibility of such a transformation. He teaches the fact that one can escape the determinisms of the universe and arrive at some consciousness which is transcendent, which he doesn't wish to define, leaves it indefinable. But whatever a human being may arrive at through that consciousness is left to their own experience. That's where he leaves it. Now, with the Christian mythos, there is a totally different approach which arises, which is that the human being carries in himself something which can overcome the conditions of the ignorance and the suffering. Now, this is exemplified in the life of one man. This is why it is in some sense relevant and parallels that line, one man's perfection yet may save the world. Now, what happens in that case is only carried theologically. It's not yogically described. And also the one man is a miracle man. In other words, whatever transcendental consciousness resides as a power to overcome the condition of suffering is something inborn in this person. So it is as if one human being is the Son of God in that sense, that he is maybe a completely divinized human from the very beginning, like a psychicized being, the very avatar of the soul man, who from that point on experiences the cosmic condition of human suffering, of the world suffering, in his own physical self, and experiences the passage out of that into a condition of transcendence that can overcome that. Now, this kind of experience, however, is only in the individual form. The individual human being experiences it. And then the mythos or the theological construct universalizes this experience for all of humanity. It says that Christ had this experience not just for his own sake. He overcame the very bedrock of suffering and death for the sake of all humanity. Now, what this will yield for the rest of humanity is left hazy. It is left as if hanging as a kind of saviorism to the condition of original sin. But it isn't made clear as to whether this affects any change in some cosmic condition on earth here. Now, again, Christianity breaks into many different forms from a very early stage. We have Gnosticism giving us a certain version. We have at least three different versions talking about Christ's life, either as a completely divine being, as divine and human at the same time, the divine subsuming the human, as divine partly and human partly. That is, the human being and the divine being have a duality between them. And as human alone, becoming divine. So all these variants exist. We also have Saint Paul, who actually denies the fact of Jesus and upholds, he makes the split between Jesus and Christ, Jesus being the individual human being with an individual human experience, and Christ being a kind of consciousness that any individual can experience. So a lot of complexity enters into the field. And then we have the mystical sort of explanations of St. John's Apocalypse, which believes in a kingdom of heaven on earth or a kind of eventual transformation of the cosmic condition. So in a sense, the promise of this kind of a teaching, one man's perfection yet may change the world, makes its entry quite early into popular, widespread human spiritual thinking, at least to whatever extent it was realized in one person. Now, last time I mentioned the teaching of Teilhard de Chardin. Teilhard de Chardin's life was sort of almost contemporary with that of Sri Aurobindo. A little later, and he died also, he came a little later, and he died also a little later. But the thing that's interesting is he takes the Christian mythos to its theological extension in a cosmic formulation. And he gives this in terms of the idea that whatever it was that Christ achieved as a human being was a validation of the transcendental anthropic principle. That is, there is a kind of transcendental person, a person, something like the model human being, that is ultimately God, that has manifested this creation and is leading it in its evolution. Now, human beings arriving on the earth have therefore each one of them the possibility of uniting with that original human divine image that they're made in. At our level, he felt that the human consciousness has evolved to a certain point where we are very close to what he called the new sphere. The new sphere for him is something that can be loosely translated as a cosmic mind, as a mind that if our minds were to contact, there would be a flashing of mental experience in which we would experience all minds at once. That kind of experience is something that Teilhard himself had. And therefore, one may say that it parallels to some extent the idea of the overmind and even the overmental transformation. However, Teilhard didn't stop here and felt that new genesis, this experience, he felt was the evolutionary immediate or imminent step for humanity. Humanity was moving in an accelerated way towards this kind of an experience of cosmic consciousness. He didn't call it cosmic consciousness, he called it new sphere. But this would be a prelude to the next step, which is what he called alternately the omega point, or sometimes Christogenesis. He used the term Christogenesis because he was thinking in terms of this original image of man, that is the fulfilled man, the perfected man, the Siddha, who is always archetypally present, guiding the evolution of the entire creation towards itself. And that would be, in a sense, the very same as what we have been calling the evolution towards the Purushottama, Purushottama Yoga. For Teilhard, this was the Christ at the very heights of creation into which every human being was being drawn, so that that step would be called Christogenesis, a step at which the Christ consciousness would be multiplied in every human being. So this is how he took the theological ideal of Christianity and gave it a formulation that may be seen by many, and is being seen by many, as paralleling, at least theologically and metaphysically, exactly what Sri Aurobindo is saying, or something very close to it at least. Now, the only thing is that this theological formulation does not give us the steps in terms of the operations of consciousness and the transformations necessary in a detailed manner. In other words, it remains theology but not psychology. It is here where we find works like Life Divine and the Synthesis of Yoga opening up a concrete psychology of transformation, a transformational psychology leading to ultimate, if you want to use that term, the union or identity with Purushottama or with Christogenesis. I think this is a very important kind of point to understand, that ultimately, whatever we call it, this is a very old spiritual problem, that whether Buddhism or Christianity or a variety of other teachings saw, intuited, perceived, and grappled with in a variety of ways, and which in today's world we are beginning to move towards in a psychological sense. So that is a certain kind of a very important point. That's why he was talking about the whole creation beginning at what he called the alpha point, but moving towards the omega point, which for him was Christogenesis, or the experience of identity with the Supreme Person multiplied in all human beings, and thus the entire cosmos relived in a perfected form outside of all its suffering and ignorance in each other.
So, Vishishta, is there a form of yoga that was detailed in Christianity with all its levels? Like, is there an equivalent of Life Divine sort of thing that is given to where it describes the darshan?
No, there isn't. This is the reason why I was saying that it remains theological and metaphysical and opens itself to these powers of experience only at an individual level. That's the reason why a variety of enormously powerful experiences have been had by Christian mystics through the power of love of Christ or through the power of the psychic in transformation and the spiritual transformation. So it's by that power opening up the knowledge within that this has been achieved. But it hasn't been codified in terms of a psychology, just as what we are talking about. Now, on the other hand, we find that the Indian tradition has been interested in developing psychology from a very early point. So this whole idea of an Indian psychology has played a very important role in trying to classify experiences and put them in a certain kind of scheme where individuals can find benefit in moving towards certain strata of consciousness. I think that's where, the entire Christian tradition can highly be complemented. I mean, I'm talking COMPLEMENT, complemented by psychological knowledge.
This is a great description of both Christianity and Buddhism. And I just want to know if in Sufi or any other forms of Islam, there is this emphasis on these fundamental problems, how we try to address. Is there some similar type of thinking and those aspects are there in Islam?
I would say there is, Sitaram. It actually goes back, when you're talking about Sufism, it actually goes back to the Gnostic traditions and even further back to various kinds of esoteric traditions that may even be at the head of the Vedic and the Chaldean traditions that the mother talks about. But what we know as Sufism is only one aspect of a variety of you know, post-Gnostic teachings, including, you know, the teachings of alchemy, for example, and other hermeticism of the West, that in symbolic forms are continuing to talk about a similar kind of transformation. The whole idea of alchemy is, in fact, a symbolic transformation of, you know, consciousness, ultimately turning it into something perfect. But in Sufism, there is a psychology. And though there is no fixed psychology, there's a number of Sufi teachers who develop very deep cosmic schemes and ways to reach them. You know, there have been great masters of Sufi learning, like one of the great names is Ibn Arabi, who, you know, dwelt in Spain. And then, of course, very famous teachers are there, like Rumi, etc. But, I mean, there have been teachers like Ibn Arabi who have created even greater cosmic schemes and transformative schemes that those who have studied these in detail can find similar teachings moving towards a transformation, but not fully developed, maybe.
Devashish?
Yes, please.
Doesn't William James hint at that a bit in his book?
He
sketches a lot of experiences that people have and point out the constituents or what makes up a mystic experience. He like categorizes things very well and seems to be working towards something about a transformation. It seems that he hints at it a little bit.
I agree with you, Vince. I think what William James does is something very modern. And
yes.
So,
oops, Devashish, I can't hear you.
Yes, Devashish, I think just dropped. One moment, let me try to add. Hear you now.
Yeah, we couldn't hear you at all before. When you started to talk about William James, that's when you dropped out.
Oh, I see. So I was saying, certainly William James stands at the head of a modern kind of endeavor to arrive at a transformational psychology. And such a endeavor looks at the various traditions of spiritual experience and tries to put them side by side and kind of get at their characteristic features, you know, and things like that. And so from that point of view, it has led to what is known as the perennial philosophy school. And a lot of work in contemporary times has arisen out of that. But you see, there is one danger, a couple of dangers with this kind of approach. One danger is that it lends itself to premature hierarchization. This putting of experiences in various hierarchic forms ultimately creates schemata which may not be accurate representations of the flexible nature of spiritual transformation. And I think where we are right now in this life divine, Sri Aurobindo will start talking about that. Start talking about the fact of how difficult it is to actually classify spiritual experience, because nothing is fully achieved until all is achieved. See, there are certain paradoxes in this whole scheme. With William James, we find that, you know, he's much more open-minded and does not create these rigid boundaries to hierarchies with experience. But one of the dangers of this kind of structuralism in experience is found in someone like, in contemporary times, in somebody like Ken Wilber, for example, who moves towards, you know, classifying spiritual mystics in terms of greater and lesser according to certain schemes of hierarchy. That is certainly not, the kind of way to go, so to say. But certainly an empirical study of spiritual experience can help a lot to arrive at a new or modern sort of field of transformative psychology.
Oh, thank you, Devashish. I think I was impressed by Williams James because he just categorized the experiences of many different Christians, and it brought up in me a lot of questions about, you know, what are all these, like, born-again people talking about? And I don't know, I just became interested in what actually are their experiences. And, he talks a lot about that I guess it's the conservative element or whatever in experience versus the like transcendentalists or the New Age people.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think it's a very important opening that he yields, which is still being assimilated. I think the legacy of William James has hardly been fully assimilated even today. And I think the new schools of perennial philosophy thinkers have done a lot to continue along this line. Sri Aurobindo is being incorporated into this kind of thinking in present times. But as I said, that just, you know, one has to be careful about how that is done.
Yeah, I think that that transformational psychology is it's kind of a nice way to look at the future. And that's what Sri Aurobindo is really
a future of human of evolution, human evolution.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
The term born again in the Christian realm has unfortunately been turned from a truly inner transformative process into a label in many cases. It's become used to describe people who are conservative Christians as born again when the actual spiritual experience of being born again is, in my opinion, a mystical experience.
Yeah, this is undoubtedly true. And in fact, what this idea of born again refers to, I mean, there's a literal translation of this term in the Indian tradition where one is born again, it's called Dvija, born a second birth, And again, the idea of Dvija, the second birth, has an external and more superficial social meaning and a mystical meaning. The superficial meaning is, of course, when Brahmin goes through the thread ceremony, he's supposed to be born again, in the same way, which is hardly, which hardly reflects the truth of the inner truth of this term. The inner truth of the term born again or Dvija is the coming, the opening up of the psyche being, of the soul personality. The awakening of the soul is the second birth, is the birth which is beyond this particular birth into the birth of the self which is born again and again. In other words, ever reborn in new lives. That particular awareness of the eternally reborn psychic being is the mystical basis of born again, whether in Christianity or Hinduism or any teaching for that matter.
Yeah, I would be interested in, I don't know, do they have Is there anything written down about what actually those experiences are that the one-day people that call themselves born-agains have? Is it, could there be, you know, I mean, I'm looking to see if there's some validity to it, or is it a just a kind of a lower vital thing, as Sri Aurobindo would say? I don't know.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see if there is kind of literature around this. I'm not sure. Maybe Janet knows about this. I can say that usually these are mystical terms that refer to something, and there is some literature around it. There is literature around it in the Sanskritic tradition. But usually they also become hazy terms in the common mind and ultimately misused terms in the social mind.
There's so many levels in Christianity of what the term born again means. You have at the deepest level, the mystical experience, the mystical transcendent experience. And then there's, from the books that I have read on it, there seems to be sort of a progression of being born again, which is what most Christian books I've read refer to, and that's a process of relinquishing your personal will to the Christ consciousness, so to speak, so that the will of God can work through you. But it's more of a gradual process of trying to free yourself from your egocentric focus to more of being a vessel through which God can act through you. That's most of the focus of the Christian books that I've read. And then, of course, you have at your most superficial level just the term born again being used to describe a particular viewpoint of a church.
Well, thank you. That's very helpful. I guess there are so many different levels to it. And sometimes it goes from the highest to something that can be really scary, you know.
Also, Janet, if you may, if you have some names of books, you might like to put them out in the message area if anybody is interested in reading some of these books. And I will also put out in the message area two books by Teilhard de Chardin that those who are interested in might like to read.
Sure. I'll go through my library and have some books ready for next from next week on the best ones that I've read.
Well, thank you.
Sure. By the way, I put out a message on two books by Teilhard de Chardin, who are maybe interested in reading. I hope you can see the message.
Yes, I can, actually. Okay, can everyone hear me okay?
Sure.
Yes.
This or something more largely planned on these lines might be regarded as the schematic, logical, or ideal account of the spiritual transformation. A structural map of the ascent to the supramental summit, looked at as a succession of separate steps, each accomplished before the passage to the next commences. It would be as if the soul, putting forth an organized, natural individuality, were a traveler mounting the degrees of consciousness cut out in universal nature. each ascent carrying it totally as a definite integer, as a separate body of conscious being, from one state of its existence to the next in autumn. This is so far correct that a sufficient integration of one status has to be complete before an ascent to the next highest station can be entirely secure. This clear succession might all, even in the early stages of this evolution, and it might become, too, a normal process after the whole stair flight of the evolution had been built and made safe. But evolutionary nature is not a logical series of separate segments. It is a totality of ascending powers of being, which interpenetrate and dovetail in exercise in their action on each other, a power of mutual modification. When the higher descends into the lower consciousness, it alters the lower, but is also modified and diminished by it. When the lower ascends, it is sublimated, but at the same time qualifies the sublimating substance and power. This interaction creates an abundant number of different intermediate and interlocked degrees of the force and consciousness of being, but it also makes it difficult to bring about a complete integration of all the powers under the full control of any one power. For this reason, there is not actually a series of simple, clear-cut in successive stages in the individual's evolution. There is instead a complexity in a partly determinant, partly confused comprehensiveness of the movement. The soul may still be described as a traveler and climber who presses towards his high goal by step on step, each of which he has to build up as an integer, but must frequently redescend in order to rebuild and make sure of the supporting stair so that it may not crumble beneath him. But the evolution of the whole consciousness has rather the movement of an ascending ocean of nature. It can be compared to a tide or a mounting flux, the leading fringe of which touches higher degrees of a cliff or hill while the rest is still below. At each stage, the higher parts of the nature may be provisionally but incompletely organized in the new consciousness, while the lower are in a state of flux of formation, partly moving in the old way, though influenced and beginning to change, partly belonging to the new kind, but still imperfectly achieved and not yet firm in the change. Another image might be that of an army advancing in columns which annexes new ground, while the main body is still behind, in a territory overrun but too large to be effectively occupied, so that it has to be a frequent halt and partial return to the traversed areas for consolidation and assurance of the hold on the occupied country in assimilation of its people. A rapid conquest might be possible, but it would be of the nature of an encampment or a domination established in a foreign country. It would not be the assumption, total assimilation, integration needed for the entire supramental change.
So here we see that something very typical of Sri Aurobindo's writing in many places, which is that he undercuts this notion of some clear-cut structure or determinism that he may himself have put forward earlier. That is, if we are to go by what has been said so far, up till this chapter, there seems to be a clear sequence that has been established. And even in the idea of a triple transformation, in which we talk about three stages, a soul or psychic transformation, a spiritual transformation, a cosmic transformation, and a supramental or transcendental transformation, there is a kind of clear-cut succession of stages. But the point he's making over here is that any such structure that we may build to understand the process is a kind of mental trap that nature does not necessarily follow, because though it may embody something which overall builds an idea with some truth in it, the movements of nature have certain complexities to them that create a very great variety of approaches that intermix and cannot be categorized so easily in terms of a hierarchy of structures. Here too, the problem of this hierarchy of structures at the human or mental level is something that is underlying Sri Aurobindo's critique of his own schema. And that is, it's all too easy in the ignorance to point to something that has been called higher and make that into some kind of put down of experiences and people at some lower level. Therefore, build a new religion in the name of something which is truly supreme, while everything else is seen as lesser to it. Now, what he's pointing out here is that in actual fact, in the individual and in the cosmic mass, there are all kinds of rise and falls that take place, which are significant and critically important to the assimilation of consciousness and the growth which will ultimately result in the possibility of a supramental change or transformation. A full-fledged psychic emergence may not have taken place before a cosmic realization takes place. Even it may be that the two go completely independent, along independent or parallel lines of experience. There is no guarantee that it is necessary in any individual that one will follow the other. A critical degree of psychic transformation is necessary for a spiritual transformation to be embodied completely. But also, it may be that spiritual transformation proceeds quite far by itself, and then a psychic transformation comes in to stabilize its gains and make the third transformation more possible. So this is how Sri Aurobindo, in a way, points to the complexity of this entire scheme that he has created, that it is not to be taken as something that we use in our mental ignorance to create classification schemes and put down others in some sort of hierarchy sense. An empirical understanding of different experiences in their similarities and differences is always a good thing, because it helps us in our own growth and our own understanding of experience. But using these to create hierarchies and put downs is a great danger that the religious life is prone to if it is taken as a kind of scheme of ascent.
Well, that's kind of what has happened in so many religions, and how they've lost their the truth that originally started the religion is that in the attempt to write it down and explain it or describe a spiritual experience, which is ultimately ineffable, the attempts to codify that end up becoming the religion instead of the transformative process.
Yes, yes, indeed, indeed, exactly.
That's kind of the story of religions to this point, isn't it?
Yeah, almost.
Yeah.
So, Devashishtha, like, in a way, like, if you, in the modern sense, like, lot of majority are moving away from standard religions and religious practices all over the world, I mean, in US, India, everywhere. Where is this a part of evolution that is happening?
I would say yes, you know, because as we see, there are three major aspects. Of course, here also earlier, Sri Aurobindo has talked about earlier approaches to the spiritual, which is he talked about philosophy, religion, occultism, and spiritual experience. Today we may also talk about three major, you know, disciplines. You know, one is you could talk about religion, philosophy, and psychology. Since today we are talking about transformative psychology, from that point of view, I'd say that the real shift that's taking place in modern times is a devaluation of theological understanding and a movement towards psychological understanding. That, you know, it is really in terms of a transformation of consciousness, a embodiment of experience, that all these things make sense rather than in some kind of structure which everybody has to believe, or a belief system as such that doesn't have individual resonance. Religions are important only to the point that individuals may accept them as, structures of individual experience. That's the kind of change, I'd say, that is happening. Now, in modern times, you say many people are a-religious or atheistic, etc. That has been one of the legacies of modernity, right from the Renaissance in Europe and the Enlightenment. That has been one of the very legacies of modernity in putting aside all obscurantism and power play in the name of something which is ultimately inexplicable. But at the same time, there has entered through the back door a new kind of psychological understanding that is opening up the boundaries of what it means to be human. So I think there, that is where the transformation of religion itself is taking place, where it is turning into more psychological knowledge than theological knowledge.
Devashish,
hello?
Yes.
Sorry. Last time I was trying to say something, my mic was muted. So, in fact, I was just wanting to know what exactly you mean by, how do you differentiate between or where exactly you differentiate between psychic and spiritual? Because when I was reading this paragraph that was just read, to my experience, it was coming as like personal and impersonal. These both power has to be sort of established. If you don't have the personality of the growth, then you The rasa is missed. Like, you know, you don't taste things that are happening. And at the same time, your personality is required for the power so that, you know, the original power of the spirit, so that that doesn't get modified. I mean, so that whatever is coming, it cannot be modified or can be less modified, whichever way. For that, that impersonality is also required. I mean, personality is also helpful sometimes, but impersonality, I think, is also required to take that quantum leap from step to step. But I was wondering, since you were using the psychic and spiritual, whether that has any relevance to the way I am perceiving.
Yes, indeed. I think it has relevance exactly as you mentioned it, in that the psychic development is a personal development. The psychic development takes place as a relationship between the individual person in the inmost sense. As the mother says, it's the innermost person in the psychological center of each human being. So that personal aspect, in its personal relationship with the divine and with other human beings, is what the psychic life is all about. That is the life that gives us the beginnings of rasa in an individualized or personalized sense. But the impersonality is related to the cosmic consciousness, because that is what ultimately allows the person to perceive that every person is nevertheless a certain kind of experience of itself. So the self with a capital S has become all these persons. So the spiritual experience or cosmic experience gives one that particular impersonality to move out of the personal into other persons. So as I was saying regarding those extents, it's very well carried over there to recognize the depth of one's own existence as a stream or a river that has taken innumerable births is the psychic experience. But to recognize the fact that all psychic experiences ultimately belong to this vast single consciousness that is perceiving itself in innumerable forms, and to identify with that is the spiritual experience or the cosmic realization. So from that point of view, the two go together, go hand in hand in creating an integral knowledge. If only one was there, then if only the spiritual was there, then there would have been an impersonal experience. But no grasp of, as you're saying, the rasa, that is really a personal factor. Ultimately, the psychic precedes the cosmic, because it is only by the integration of the two that one personalizes the cosmic. Even impersonality and innumerable lives can be personalized, can be seen as one's own life. That is where the psychic being moves into another station. That's why this paragraph that we read, Sri Aurobindo is talking about it as the journey of the psychic being. The psychic being has first its own life, which is the life, many lives it has led. But the psychic being can change its status and become the cosmic being. There it recognizes itself as all the lives that have been lived. And so that idea of the person enters into the impersonality. And ultimately, the realization of the transcendent, of the supramental, needs the basis of the full establishment of both these kinds of experiences.
Beautiful. Actually, that's exactly what I was thinking in that direction, because in my experience, like that, that personal aspect, because it is so much grounded in love, that that love itself is cannot be bound, right? It cannot be bound in a body or in an environment or in a culture. So when that comes out, actually demands for that cosmic perspective, or it prays, even if it doesn't have inner power. It prays, calls upon, you know, some higher power automatically, because it cannot stay rested in that kind of, you know, faltering expression of love where it has to compromise.
Yeah, absolutely. Very true.
Devashish?
Yeah, yes.
I have a question. The William James book, or this categorizing of experience that he did, the basis of religion used to be that one person had these experiences and it was codified, as Janet said, made into a religion. This, the codification of different experiences, it just seems like there's so many people that have had these experiences.
Right.
Or is that like something that's more pronounced lately, do you think? Was it always like that, but no one said anything?
Yeah, this is remarkable, because I think you're exactly right. That it was always, I think it was always like that. I mean, you know, religions are created by privileging the experience of one person and making that into an ideal. But innumerable human beings have had spiritual experiences. Some have expressed them, some haven't expressed them. Some have come under a religion and remained esoteric within the boundaries of that religion. Some have remained outside the boundaries of any religion and therefore remained unknown. So it's, from that point of view, this is exactly what I was saying. It's a modern endeavor to universalize the definition of the human in a new way that includes this dimension and makes it appear that all human beings are capable of having these experiences.
Vince, have you read The Perennial Philosophy by Aldous Huxley?
No, I haven't.
That is...
That's what I should do, yes.
That is an excellent book. And I think part of what's happening recently, it just seems like we're hearing more about these types of experiences from all different cultures, because in the last, you know, 40 or 50 years, we have so much more exposure and access to, you know, international travel and access to people, you know, with the internet and everything. It's just the world's getting smaller in some ways. But Perennial Philosophy, will, it goes back and it lists mystical experiences throughout the centuries, going back and some of the commonalities and differences from all different cultures, from India, from China, the Christian mysticism and things like that. And it's a great book. I would highly recommend it. The other, I put in the
notes. I saw what you read. It's the Underhill book?
Yes. That is Evelyn Underhill studied Christian mystics and came up with a it's not really a hierarchy, but stages of the mystical experience. But she also cautions that those are general stages and they don't necessarily have to happen in order. Some can happen all at once. Some stages might be skipped entirely. But in studying a great variety of the Christian mystics, she found some generalities that can be categorized into, quote, stages, like an initial initiation that a person has that opens their consciousness up to illumination is another stage. And then you've probably heard the term the dark night of the soul is a stage where the contact with the divine mind seemingly withdraws from the person's life and they experience a spiritual dryness. And then in the what she calls the final stage is unitive consciousness, where the person has achieved unity with the divine mind, so that an influx of divine energy is flowing through that person. But she strongly cautions that not to view this as a one-step, two-step, three-step process.
Oh, no, thank you. I look at both those books with interest. But that sounds nice. I enjoy reading about that, that type of experience. Thank you.
Yeah, there's the other one.
Okay, good.
Very, very good.
Bless yourself. If I could jump in into the discussion.
Sure.
I was thinking, you know, when you were saying about religions being privileging one person's spiritual experience, and yes, I can see that viewpoint, but I was also wondering about when Sri Aurobindo talks in the methods of Vedantic knowledge, where one mystic sort of affirms their experiences of another mystic. What dost thou know? And I guess in one sense, one can do that only if one is somehow centered in the universal or cosmic consciousness to be able to truly get into someone else's consciousness. And in that sense, then religion is no longer a privileging of one person's experience. It is being affirmed by a privileged group, privileged in the sense who are truly experiencing this. Does that make sense?
Yeah, surely it makes sense. That's exactly what a community, a spiritual community is all about when it has reached a certain standard or level. So mystic communities, whether they're monastic communities or social communities, have existed in the past. And Sri Aurobindo talks about this, that, you know, I mean, even the evolution of mankind is not a sort of, in the life divine itself. I think in one of the earlier chapters he has talked about this, that we have reached spiritual heights as society which are much greater than where we are today. But perhaps the least common denominator is higher today than before. However, you're absolutely right. He does talk about, you know, the methods of Vedantic knowledge, I believe, rest on a certain generalization of some degree of over mental consciousness, not necessarily the over mind proper, but at least the higher mind, you know, some degree where the personal and the impersonal meet. It's necessary for a dialogue that opens up new ranges of knowledge which are universal.
Thank you.
Oh, Debashish?
Yeah, yes, Vince?
Isn't that, I mean, I kind of think of most religions as being dry, but what you were just discussing seems to be like spirituality to me. Maybe I'm not distinguishing them correctly, but I always think of like this kind of open-minded exchange of ideas at a or a consciousness at a higher level. To me, I just think of that as spirituality rather than religion.
Sure. See, today we make the distinction. It's become much more, trenchant, this distinction between spirituality and religion. Because, in fact, so much plurality exists in the religious domain, that each one of these religions has tried to define itself narrowly. But the term religion has a whole range, and religious societies have existed in the past which have belonged to one particular group, maybe. I mean, old ancient Christian mystics or Buddhist monastic life has spawned cultures that to some extent were restricted to a certain, system. But within that system, nevertheless, developed a tremendous degree of freedom in discussing experience and moving forward, moving ahead. Of course, when we are talking about methods of Vedantic knowledge, we can talk about some sort of system which is, in a sense, not rigid in any way, I mean, which ultimately opens itself to infinite experience. That's not really what one might call a religion, which is bounded. But even within religions, there have been kind of possibilities of growth in other times and other cultures that have been remarkable in this particular way, in the growth of mysticism in groups of people.
Isn't this all very much connected to the subject that we're on? I mean,
yeah, I think
seeing
so.
Things in the over mind, it's like the development of everything to its fullest and completest.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But, you know, this human mind, I think, is very tricky, right? So when we talk, like, we are not even fully aware where, how much we are bound. And so basically, it's the transition between us being open and getting back to the, you know, religiosity and whatever it means. Is probably happening all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why it's also a function of time. And you know, that's exactly what he's talking about in this paragraph. That sometimes, you know, the crest of the wave goes far ahead and there's seemingly a great advance that is made. But as a matter of fact, certain aspects have been left behind and are far behind, even in a single individual. And so then that's why he's saying there must be repeated descents to integrate those things that are kind of left behind. That, you know, it's amazing how time, the irony of history, reveals some of our greatest, you know, exaltations of the past to actually be completely the reverse. Because we exalted in some moment of human history due to a certain perception of some greatness in some level. But other ways of looking at it made it look rather ridiculous or even, you know, downright evil. So this really calls for this kind of integration, which we can't see in its fullness. Only gradually we begin to integrate all the various parts of our experience.
That example of foreign rule was very nice.
Yeah, the war and foreign rule examples you're talking about in that paragraph, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Amazing. The kind of analogies that Sri Aurobindo picks up sometimes. He takes an example from nature, which is that of the waves and the tides, an example from war, and an example from politics and kind of global culture, almost.
Yeah, that was an amazing paragraph, wasn't it?
Keka, would you like to read?
Yes, one second. This entails certain consequences. Successions of the evolution and prevent it from following the cleanly determined and firmly arranged course, which our logical intelligence demands from nature, but seldom from us. As life and mind begin to appear when the organization of matter is sufficient to admit them, But the more complex and perfect organization of matter comes with the evolution of life and mind. As mind appears, when life is sufficiently organized to admit of a developed vibration of consciousness, but life receives its full organization and development only after mind can act upon it. As the spiritual evolution begins when man, as mind is capable of the movements of spirituality, but mind also rises to its own highest perfection by the growth of the intensities and luminosities of the spirit. So it is with this higher evolution of the ascending power spirit. As soon as there is a sufficient spiritual development, something of intuition, illumination of the being, the movements of the higher spiritual grades of consciousness begins to manifest. Sometimes one, sometimes the other, or all together. And they do not wait for each power in the series to complete itself before a higher power comes into action. An overmind light and power may descend in some sort, create a partial form of itself in the being, and take a leading part or supervise or intervene, while the intuitive and illumining mind and higher mind are still incomplete. These would then remain in the whole, acting along with the greater power, often penetrated or sublimated by it, or rising into it to form a greater or overmind vision, a greater or overmind illumination, a greater or overmind spiritual thinking. This intricate action takes place because each descending power of its by its intensity of pressure on the nature, an uplifting effect makes the being already capable of a still higher ambition before that earlier power itself is complete in its self-formation. But also it happens because the work of assumption and transformation of the lower nature can with difficulty be done if a higher and higher intervention does not take place. Okay. The illumination and the higher thought need the help of the intuition. The intuition needs the help of the overmind to combat the darkness or ignorance in which they labor and to give them their own fullness. Still, it is not possible in the end for the overmind status and integration to be complete until the higher mind and illumined mind have been integrated and taken up into the intuition, and the intuition itself subsequently integrated and taken up into the all and all enlarging and all sublimating overmind energy. The law of the gradation has to be satisfied even in the complexity of the process of evolutionary nature. Ooh, wow.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, the point he's making is that there is so much complexity to the spiritual movement that something very high may come into us and act, and when it acts, it actually substitutes for a lot of lower things. I mean, so he gives us example of something from the overmind which can begin to act in some people. This is why you see the whole idea about the spiritual experiences of the past is so complex to higher archives. One can codify and compare, but to higher archives, because as he's pointing out, you know, one may have a certain experience or realization of a very high kind, but and it may also have an effect on other parts of the nature, because it subsumes some of their actions, but not until the internal capacities of every level of consciousness express themselves in their full and are integrated in or with the higher, can any fullness of consciousness, of the scale of consciousness, be expressed, be secure and be expressed. So that's what he is pointing out over here through this example of some higher consciousness that may find an opening in some part of the nature. Again, this is often due to the fact that every individual is constituted differently, and we have some parts of our being which are attuned to certain intensities of consciousness, which may be quite different from other parts. Certain parts may call down or be visited by something of a completely different level of consciousness than what the rest of the being is used to. And that might start acting in that particular expression. So that's the example he is giving. When that happens, it may be as if a person rises to another level altogether in many different ways. But still, until and unless those things that are being substituted rise in their own level, in their own power, there cannot be an integration and secure foundation of a higher consciousness. This is part of the, you know, what he's saying, law of gradation, which needs to be satisfied, even in the complexity of the process of evolution. This discussion also relates to what Sri Aurobindo says in The Hour of God. This idea of the Hour of God, he brings out, in a small essay, where he says that there are times when there is a cosmic consciousness which expresses very powerfully through a certain milieu. So wherever that is, even common people suddenly start manifesting something of a much higher nature. And, you know, it's as if the humans overnight become gods. But this is a temporary phenomenon. And once the age passes, humanity falls, as it were, to a much more mundane level of existence. We may have seen things of that kind in our own lifetimes, or even if we look at the last 100 or 150 years, we may say that similar things have happened. The turn of the 19th and 20th century was such a period of an hour of God, when a tremendous intensity of consciousness expressed itself in many ways in many parts of the world, and great heroes were born who broke many frontiers of knowledge and experience. But this has fallen, in a sense, to a condition of humanity which is much more mundane in our own times. Perhaps this is exactly the kind of thing he's talking about, where the great names that we have from the turn of the 20th century only expressed something higher that never managed to integrate itself. And today, we are seeing the result of that assimilation process that needs to occur before a full security of a higher level of consciousness can manifest itself.
Within a individual person that has experienced what you call the hour of God, and then to return once that has faded to a more mundane existence can be an incredibly painful experience.
Absolutely, absolutely. No doubt about it. That's why the descent, so-called descent, that he's talking about, and you mentioned the dark night of the soul, idea of the dark night of the soul could also be a repeated experience, not just once, as a kind of eschatological sort of, you know, penultimate stage, but it could also be something that is part of a continuous progression of ascents and descents. Each descent is almost experienced as a night of God, because in that particular condition, there is a loss of that same, sense of presence. But it has really gone behind the curtain, as it were, behind the veil, and is preparing the ground of that which was not ready, and which took substitute sort of action as its own.
Devashish.
Yeah.
Couldn't a dark night of the soul, you could think of that in a cosmic sense?
How? Oh.
I'm just thinking. What happened? I think particularly since say 73 and all, with the dying of the mother, and it just seems that there's so much resistance that's come up.
Yeah, if that's what you mean. Yes, you're absolutely right. The dark night of the soul is a cosmic. It can be a cosmic phenomenon, and that's how I was seeing it originally. So it is both an individual and a cosmic phenomenon. In fact, the dark night of the soul is almost a kind of a exact counterpart of the idea of the hour of God.
Yeah.
So you have the hour of God and you have the dark night of the soul. I mean, they seem to follow each other in that sense that, you're left with an absence and you have to cope with it. But actually, it's not really an absence. It's a stage of preparation and assimilation.
I realize that I've jumped into this, the life divine towards the end of it. What are there specific practices that Sri Aurobindo talks about to assist in the transformation of consciousness? I'm assuming it would be meditation and things like that.
Yeah, as far as the practices go, Janet, it's more in the synthesis of yoga where he talks about that. As far as this work goes, the life divine goes, of course, the practices are kind of, backgrounding most of the writing, but it's really a cosmology and a metaphysics that he's creating over here, also a phenomenology in the sense that it's the perceptions of his own experiences that he's recording here. But how one can get there, what are the various stages in the development of the consciousness, and the different practices that that can be used, that all comes in the work of the synthesis of yoga.
Now, when you say yoga, that has many different meanings to me. I know it's translates as union, but when I think of yoga, I think of like postures, physical postures and breathing.
Yeah, that is one particular kind of yoga which is actually most commonly understood in today's Western world. But yoga includes the entire gamut of spiritual discipline. Yoga and the way in which he's using it in that book has to do with the practices of devotion, the practices of meditation, the practices of desireless works, the practices of aspiration for perfection. All these practices constitute yoga. And so that's what he's talking about in that book. There are other places, of course, where he talks about that. I think is the most well-recognized treatise on this subject that you just raised.
Devashish?
Yeah.
Isn't it? I mean, I always like that little book, Lights on Yoga. It gives, some practical hints, I thought.
Yeah, of course. I mean, so there are other compilations like Lights on Yoga. There is what is called Bases of Yoga.
Yeah.
Janet was an ex-student of the University of Philosophical Research, and I think Obadiah Harris always swore by that little book called The Basis of Yoga. Uh-huh. And then you have the book called Integral Yoga, which is a compilation of letters, you know, brought out by the archives, made by Richard Hartz and Peter Hees, which actually is also, I think, a really good introduction to the practices of the integral of Sri Aurobindo's yoga.
Devashish, I was just going to add to the list the little book by Sri Aurobindo called The Mother. I think that's a wonderful start to.
Yeah, absolutely. The little book called The Mother is actually a very powerful, you know, certain direction for the practice of Sri Aurobindo's yoga.
Yeah, it's very wonderful.
And there is the record of yoga, which I've considered, I mean, I've been more and more sort of drawn towards. And, you know, there is a course at the University of Philosophical Research that I teach based on the record of yoga at this time, called the Yoga of Integral Transformation, that also opens up this entire area of practice.
When is the next class on integral yoga that you are teaching? Do you know what that schedule is yet?
Yeah, I teach it in every winter quarter, which essentially, you know, just got over, I think,
okay.
Right now. So it'll return in the period from February to April, I think. That's the time period.
Okay.
Keto had a question?
No, I mean, it's not important. I was just saying that, you know, these books, like The Mother, for example, sometimes it has such a, I mean, you know, a high impact, I think. And sometimes, you know, La Divine helps. So basically, it's like a different kind of, receptivity we have of different parts of being at different times. So I think based on that, you know, different books have different impacts at different point of time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for somebody who wants to get an overview of the field of practice in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, letters on yoga and synthesis of yoga seem to be the most wide-ranging. And then the others really give a more intense kind of experience of that field.
Luis, would you like to read next?
How does this, is this clear?
Yes, very clear.
A further cause of complexity arises from the need of integration itself, for the process is not only an ascent of the soul to a higher status, but a descent of the higher consciousness so gained to take up and transform the inferior nature. But this nature has a density of previous formation, which resists and obstructs the descent. Even when the higher power has broken the barrier and descended and is at work, we have seen that the nature of the ignorance resists and obstructs the working, that it either strives to refuse transformation altogether or tries to modify the new power into some conformity with its own workings, or even throws itself upon it to seize and degrade and enslave it to its own way of action and lower purpose. Ordinarily, in their task of assumption and assimilation of this difficult stuff of nature, the higher powers descend first into the mind and occupy the mind centers because these are nearest to themselves in intelligence and knowledge power. If they descend first into the heart or into the vital being of force and sensation, as they sometimes do because these happen to be in some individuals more open and called them first, the results are more mixed and dubious, imperfect and insecure than if things happen in the logical order. But even in its normal working, when it takes up the being part by part in the natural order of descent, this descending power is not able to bring about a total occupation and transformation of each before it goes farther. It can only affect a general and incomplete occupation, so that the workings of each remain still partly of the new higher, partly of a mixed, partly of the old, unchanged lower order. All the mind in its whole range cannot be transmuted at once, for the mind centers are not isolated from the rest of the being. The mind action is penetrated by the action of the vital and physical parts, and in those parts themselves are lower formations of mind, a vital mind, a physical mind, and these have to be changed before there can be an entire transformation of the mental being. The higher transforming power has, therefore, to descend as soon as may be and without waiting for an integral mental change into the heart, so as to occupy and change the emotional nature and afterwards into the inferior vital centers to occupy and change the whole vital and kinetic and sensational nature, and finally into the physical centers so as to occupy and change the whole physical nature. But even this finality is not final, for there are still left the subconscient parts and the inconscient foundation. The intricacy, interwoven action of these powers and parts of the being is so great that it may almost be said that in this change, nothing is accomplished until all is accomplished. There is a tide and ebb, the forces of the old nature receding and again partially occupying their old dominions, effectuating a slow retreat and rear-line actions and return attacks and aggressions. The higher influx occupying each time more conquered territory, but imperfectly sure of sovereignty so long as anything is left that has not become part of its luminous regime.
So here he is pointing to a second cause of complexity. And the first one was that this process may occur unevenly. New things may enter into the nature, but ultimately everything must ascend and develop its own consciousness towards the divine. There is a consolidation of the different powers in the range of consciousness that need each of them to be developed. Not only by rising to a higher level, this is again where that whole hierarchic idea is complicated, which is in the fact that it's not just by rising to some summit that the whole problem is solved, but it is in particularly developing the spiritual potential of each rung of the consciousness, each stage of the consciousness, that an integrated personality, a divine personality, can emerge. Now, in the second cause of complexity, what he's pointing out is again, two things. One is that in the working of the higher, in the descending force, in whatever manages to express itself in us, which is of a higher nature, there is a modification of that by the lower, by that which cannot, understand the law of the higher, which is the ignorance of the lower parts of the nature. But also there is the falsehood, which is the desire of the ignorance to remain ignorant, the challenge to the higher powers, because there is resistance and, the element which opposes, the opposing element in man. So this notion of something that wishes to remain what it is, partly due to its investment in its evolutionary mechanism that has allowed it to survive, and partly due to something contrary in the nature, which almost takes a delight in its opposition to the higher consciousness, is something that has to be dealt with in the transformation of the being. And in this, he points out how the difficulty of addressing the lower forms of consciousness come in the way. And he points to this whole rung of obscurity coming down from the human mind into what we call the human heart, which on the one hand has a great fiery intensity in its love of God, in its love of truth or of the divine, but on the other hand is a highly mixed up place, full of all kinds of petty egoism, various movements of possessiveness, jealousy, misunderstanding, and other kinds of egoism that infected from the lower ranges of what Sri Aurobindo is calling the vital or the life being in us. And then he says even lower are the more unconscious parts which constitute the physical, the subconscious, and the inconscient. The inconscient being like a kind of a dumb sleep form of consciousness close to death. So this is the range that constitutes us. And in its attempt to bring the fullness of consciousness, even if there is a power that descends, it finds itself obstructed progressively by each of these layers of consciousness. So we find that to even effect a certain degree of integration at a higher level, there can be no security until and unless even lower levels are addressed. And that's why the higher force in its descent may start working more powerfully at higher levels of the consciousness. But at the same time, it has to infiltrate into lower levels as well and start its working almost all at once at all the levels of the being, so that the lower levels may not upsurge and destroy whatever has been achieved at a higher level. So this kind of complexity that is introduced causes a certain type of a seesaw movement from level to level of the being, where the consolidation takes a long time to achieve itself. But it is almost, as he says, as if that nothing changes, nothing is accomplished until all is accomplished. That's the nature of the complexity, which is why a successive understanding of this entire transformative process is hardly adequate to a full description of the integral yoga.
Sister, shall we close the session today here, after shall we read in one more paragraph?
I think we can close today. It's past 9:30. We just have to. Maybe we should read the third paragraph because it's a short paragraph, and it really completes the idea. And we can reconsider it next time. But it might be a good idea to read it because that third complexity, as he says, that's brought in, is introduced two forms of complexity. This is the third complex.
Jen, would you like to read?
Sure. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. A third complexity is brought in by the power of the consciousness to live in more than one status at a time. Especially, a difficulty is created by the division of our being into an inner and outer or surface nature. And the farther intricacy of a secret circumconscient or environmental consciousness in which we are determined our unseen connections with the world outside us. In the spiritual opening, it is the awakened inner being that readily receives and assimilates the higher influences and puts on the higher nature. The external surface self, more entirely molded by the forces of the ignorance and inconscience, is slower to awake, slower to receive, slower to assimilate. There is therefore a long stage in which the inner being is sufficiently transformed, but the outer is still involved in a mixed and difficult movement of imperfect change. This disparity repeats itself at each step of the ascent. For in each change, the inner being follows more readily. The outer limps after, reluctant or else incompetent in spite of its aspiration and desire. This necessitates a constantly repeated labor of assumption, adaptation, orientation, a labor reproduced in new terms always, but always the same in principle. But even when the outer and the inner nature of the individual are unified in a harmonized spiritual consciousness, that still more external but occult part of him in which his being mixes with the being of the outside world and through which the outside world invades his consciousness remains a field of imperfection. There is necessarily a commerce here between disparate influences. The inner spiritual influence is met by quite opposite influences, strong in their control of the present world order. The new spiritual consciousness has to bear the shock of the dominant and established unspiritualized powers of the ignorance. This creates a difficulty which is of capital importance in all stages of the spiritual evolution and its urge towards a change of the nature. Wow.
So here he introduces the third problem of complexity. The first problem of complexity being that the consciousness needs the ascent of every level of the nature, both the ascent into A-S-S-E-N-T and A-S-C-E-N-T, to spiritualize the whole being. The second one in that all must be accomplished for anything to be accomplished, in other words, makes it difficult for anything to be accomplished in its fullness. It's not that things proceed from top down, but the top itself cannot be fully integrated unless gradually more and more of the lower levels become transformed. And the third one is here being introduced as the differentiation between the inner and the outer. This idea of the inner and the outer is a very important one in Sri Aurobindo, because ultimately what is mediating between the innermost divine soul in us and the outer nature are these layers of what he calls inner consciousness, or subliminal being. The term subliminal being refers to this inner mind, inner life, and inner body consciousness in Sri Aurobindo, which are intermediate between the soul and what we take to be ourselves in our mind, life, body, reality. So this also he draws into a wider kind of a zone, which he calls the circumconscient, which is what he says, the construction of our consciousness by the outer environing nature. We are, largely products of constructed consciousness that are the result of interactions with the social milieu. And so that part of us which allows or needs to allow itself to respond to the social norms and conventions of the outside has a certain consciousness which it treats to be normative. Deep down inside, a whole yogic action may be taking place, and yet that action cannot fully realize itself in the outer nature until these walls or gaps between the inner and the outer nature are not bridged or overcome. So that's exactly where, also the whole teaching of the conditions of consciousness, avasthas, as the Upanishads call them, the waking, the dreaming, and the deep sleep conditions are in a sense being experienced by us simultaneously. It isn't that we enter into the dream state only when we sleep. It is the entire subjective subliminal consciousness that is going on even while we are awake and we don't know anything about it. Or we know only that much about it that escapes as kinds of experiences in our waking condition. But if this wall is changed, if one lives within, gradually there can be an obliteration of this distinction, and one can have a much deeper power of consciousness and experience of consciousness, even in one's waking self. This is ultimately, what Sri Aurobindo calls samadhi. Samadhi not only in with eyes closed, as it were, but with eyes open and bridging the various conditions or avasthas of Jagrat, Swapna, and Sushupti. That is the third complexity that exists in this enterprise of integration.
Towards the end of this paragraph, when he talks about the more external but occult part of him, in which his being mixes with the being of the outside world, and through which the outside world invades his consciousness, that's the definition for what he calls the environmental consciousness or the circumconscient consciousness, right?
Yeah, that's how I take it also. That is the circumconscious or the environmental consciousness through which, in a sense, our surface consciousness is constructed occultly through this interchange that is taking place with the universal.
I think the question that arises in me is when we're using the word constructed, is it just what we call socially culturally constructed, or is there a deeper, more occult and spiritual significance to this part of our being?
I'd say there is a deeper and more occult spiritual significance to this part of our being. But I'd also say that what we call social and cultural construction is an occult construction. That the reality of social construction is basically an occult operation through which the environment is forming us, is shaping us. It's
sure.
That's only part of it. But, that part also is part of the occult action of the officer.
Sure. And, I mean, in a way, there's nothing outside the divine. Everything is somehow in this divine leela. I guess another way to clarify my question would be, is the circumconscient consciousness just something that is developed with the evolution of Prakriti, or is it something which is part of the upward evolution of the Purusha? I don't know if I'm expressing that properly.
I'm not sure if I get you right, Bindu, but I would say that it is part of the evolution of Prakriti. That is, certainly the cosmic Prakriti in its evolution has created this intermixture by which the individual and the cosmic are related in nature.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Shall we end with a brief meditation?
Yeah, let's end with a brief meditation, and then next week we can resume.